the research director of the Regenerative Bioengineering and Repair Lab, or what we call the Rebar Lab. That's actually out of the Division of Plastic Surgery, Department of Surgery, at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. We are actually through the Division of Plastic Surgery because we work with a population of stem cells that we isolate from liposuction fat tissue. So these adipose-derived stem cells are taken literally from lipoaspirates that are sucked out at cosmetic facilities or even here at UCLA, which is why we're through the Division of Plastic Surgery. So my second talk is going to be just a brief talk on differentiation and apoptosis. But right now, we're going to cover briefly the very broad topic of receptor-ligand interactions, cell signaling, adhesion, motility, and migration. There's no way I can do this in 60 minutes. There's no way. These are whole entire courses. So I thought I would just focus on pretty well the idea of some cell signaling and adhesion and leave the motility and migration to maybe the next series of seminars we have next year. But feel free to stop me at any time and ask me questions and we can have a discussion. So this, I want this, you know, to be a nice free flow kind of discussion. But basically, you have to realize that no cell lives in isolation. We are an accumulation of millions and millions of cells that group together to form specialized tissues. But
talk about, you know, you didn't put us to sleep, but you put
I put the computer to sleep. Okay, is this thing plugged in? I am in isolation. Okay, now we're starting up again. Anyway, no cell lives in isolation. But apparently I'm standing up here all by myself with no computer. We are, like I said, an accumulation of tissues, and these tissues can be made up of millions and millions of cells, and in order for our body to function at homeostasis, and we have all heard the term homeostasis before, our tissues have to coordinate with one another, and those cells within the tissue have to coordinate with one another, so that cells need to talk to one another. Cells, you heard, I'm sure, yesterday from Hama that he talked to you about the plasma membrane and how the membrane was structured and how it functions. Oh, we're back. It suddenly decided that it wanted to, I don't know, make an appearance on it. There we go. So yesterday's lectures were about cell membrane structure, or are you getting to that? Okay, so you guys, for those of you who were unfamiliar with the plasma membrane, you had a little bit of a primer, or an hour or two, in learning about how our cells are surrounded by a plasma membrane. Now, this plasma membrane is the first contact with the environment. It's how the cell learns about its external environment, and it's actually how the how one cell can talk to another cell. So we're going to talk a little bit about those actual mechanisms, and we're going to have a brief conversation on the wonderful world of signal transduction. When I say it's a wonderful world, okay, we'll get this going again. There it is. Let's try it again. There's no pressure. They're just staring at me. I don't know why it did that.
Because it's Windows.
It hates me. Computers hate me. And I need it because I need to know what we're going to talk about. Come on. Talk amongst yourselves. Any questions so far? Okay, well, we're actually going to spell bioengineering right there. I corrected that last time. I'm like, oh, okay, very first page spelling mistake. There you go. Onwards and upwards. Slideshow. And if it does it again, all right, here we go. So survival of cells within a tissue depends on an elaborate intercellular communication network. So this coordinates things like growth of cells, differentiation or specialization of cells, the metabolism of the cells. And cells adjacent to one another, neighboring cells, frequently communicate with one another through cell-to-cell contact. But also a tremendous amount of signaling in our body between cells occurs over long distances. We call this kind of signaling extracellular signaling. And those molecules and compounds that are involved in this are called extracellular signaling molecules. So we're going to have just a brief little conversation on this, if all goes well with the computer. Now, when you read textbooks, if you were to open up, say, Molecular Biology of the Cell by Lodish, which to me is the Bible of molecular and cell biology, they define signaling molecules as being compounds or chemicals that are released by signaling cells. And the actual signal itself is given the specialized name ligand or ligand, tomato, tomato, depending where you're from. So ligand or ligand. Now this ligand will travel and bind onto a target cell. So the cell that it binds onto is given the name target cell. And what it binds onto is called a receptor. So on our surface of all our cells is a wide variety of receptors that are specific to very distinct signaling molecules called ligands. Now, this specificity is actually important for making sure that the cell responds in a controlled manner. So for example, I have on the surface of some of my cells a receptor to the hormone estrogen, and only that receptor will bind on to that hormone. So there's no way this receptor, this estrogen receptor, will bind on and physically make a connection, say, with insulin. So cell signaling in our body is extremely specific. Once this ligand-receptor interaction occurs, there are a series of cellular events that take place called the cellular response. And this cellular response could be anything from maybe an increase in proliferation. Maybe it will tell the cell to start differentiating. Maybe this receptor-ligand interaction will cause a cellular response that results in the cell undergoing a controlled cell death or apoptosis. So there are a wide variety of cellular responses. And these cell signaling molecules are a vast array of compounds. Some of the classified compounds that have been studied are small amino acid derivatives, just groups maybe of two or three amino acid derivatives, smaller chunks of amino acids called peptides, and even large-scale proteins. Are known to take place in this process. Now, when you read all your textbooks and they break it down to nice simple steps, cell-to-cell communication by extracellular signaling is usually involves six main steps. Number one, you've got to have the signaling cell and it's got to make this signaling molecule, this ligand. The cell has to release this ligand to the external environment. This ligand has to travel to its target cell. The target cell has to physically either bind it through receptors on the surface or maybe internalize the cell signaling molecule. So we have, again, the idea of receptor ligand specificity. Once this binding takes place, there's usually a change in either cellular metabolism or function or a development of the cell. This is the cellular response. And then the signal has to be removed. We can't have the signal going on continuously. So the signal has to be degraded in some way so that the cellular response shuts down. So six very basic boom, 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 boom steps, and you result in cell-to-cell communication. Now, when we look at cell-cell communication, signaling can either occur in very small distances, signaling can take place over large distances, or sometimes the signal that the cell produces can actually feed back onto itself. So when you read in molecular biology textbooks about extracellular signaling, they give three main mechanisms. They give an endocrine mechanism, a paracrine mechanism, and an autocrine mechanism. So let's start with the endocrine mechanism. And this is basically long-distance signaling. It says that cells in one area of the body can send out extracellular signals that act on a part of a tissue or a cell at an extremely large distance. These signaling compounds, in this case, are generally hormones, called hormones. They are usually carried through the bloodstream, and this is the idea of endocrine signaling. Hormone secretion by a group of cells travels through the bloodstream and it acts on distant target cells. Now, these groups of cells that are responsible for the synthesis and secretion of these hormones are generally called endocrine glands, and you've got loads of them. You've got a thyroid, a pituitary, you've got a pancreas, adrenal glands. These are all examples of endocrine glands. They secrete hormones. These hormones act on a systemic level. But if you're signaling over a short distance, say for example you have a secretory cell here and right next door is its target, this short distance signaling is called paracrine signaling. So you're dealing with the idea of proximity. Now, this type of signaling is usually the area of neurotransmitters in the nervous system and a lot of our growth factors that you may have heard of, things like fibroblast growth factor, epidermal growth factor, hepatocyte growth factor, all these growth factors. And the final type is basically what I call no distance. or autocrine signaling. This is a feedback kind of mechanism where the cell secretes a compound and it feeds back on itself.
When you're talking about paracrine signaling, how far is that? Must it be adjacent cells, or are we talking about within
I imagine it's even within a few cells, so within tissue.
Does not require like an epithelial adjacent cell?
No, no. But you're not going to turn around and
it's
signal.
It's an diffusive transport.
Yes. So the signal feeds back here in this little cartoon. It's secreted and it feeds back and binds onto receptors that it itself expresses. So you'll see this actually a lot in tumor cells. This is an area of research that tumor biologists deal with, because the tumor cell will secrete a growth factor that will feed back right onto that cell and cause it to proliferate in an uncontrolled manner. Now, a lot of the compounds that you may read about are not expressly restricted to one type of signaling mechanism. So a lot of growth factors can signal maybe through paracrine and autocrine. And some hormones may secrete not only through endocrine but through paracrine mechanisms, and some compounds may even utilize all three signaling mechanisms. So it's a very dynamic sort of fluid system. We're not getting just one restricted kind of signaling for one particular kind of molecule. When we talk about hormones, we basically have two kinds. We have those that act locally and those that circulate. And again, those that circulate act on distant targets. These are called endocrine hormones. And the local hormones that I'm talking about basically act through paracrine and autocrine mechanisms. And this, again, just a cute little diagram out of the Lotus textbook showing you an endocrine cell. And again, the three types of signaling we just covered. So for example here, hormones can operate on all three signaling mechanisms. We have two types of hormones in our body. They are either lipid-soluble or water-soluble. So in other words, they're either lipophilic, or I guess hydrophilic would be the other word. Lipid-soluble, water-soluble. The lipid-soluble hormones that are involved in cell signaling can easily enter a cell. The plasma membrane, you learned, is a phospholipid bilayer. So if anything is lipophilic or lipophilic, it'll have no problem binding or diffusing through the plasma membrane. Most of our lipid-soluble hormones diffuse through the plasma membrane and actually bind onto receptors found inside the cell, because they have no problem getting into the cell. But there is a big fat problem in that the water, the blood that transports these hormones is water-based. So we have a problem transporting these circulating lipid-soluble hormones. So they're generally carried in the blood via a carrier protein. They easily enter the cell across the plasma membrane, and they bind onto receptors generally found in the cytosol, just floating around in the interior of the cell. Most of our lipid-soluble hormones then get translocated into the nucleus, where they bind onto specific DNA sequences and turn a gene on or turn a gene off.
Why wouldn't they just go to red blood cells? There's also a
exactly know what how maybe the carrier protein does involve.
Well, there's another concentration right
at
the end
of
the receptors
and none inside the blood. And there's no nucleus in a red blood cell either, so it would make no point. There's no point in it entering the.
Well, the hormone doesn't know that there's no nucleus inside it, only sees the super nice there.
Well, I imagine that means we've evolved mechanisms for it not to enter red blood cells. It's a good question. I don't know. It's like, yeah, one would think. I imagine the carrier protein and the hormone make a physical interaction, and if the
but it would not move into the cell.
It's probably a physical interaction.
Because
yeah,
there's no receptor.
These guys are worried about
because
physics problem.
Yeah.
No.
And
they're also bound to a carrier protein, and once it binds onto this carrier protein, it's a pretty large complex. It'll find it probably pretty difficult to diffuse across the plasma membrane. things that are going to diffuse across the plasma membrane are going to be small. And when it binds onto this carrier protein, it's probably too large to diffuse into a red blood cell.
This argument works just as much for the cell as it's actually supposed to enter.
Well, then I don't know the mechanism. Then it gets released from the carrier protein and diffuses through once it gets to its target. Way beyond the scope of this seminar.
Got it.
And
no, that's what
I don't know the mechanism.
That's what we're trying to find out.
Yeah.
Your job is to present what you know about the biology, and our job is to try and interpret that. I might be a bit of a mediator because I don't know about biology and I don't know about physics. So
yeah.
I can kind of then these guys want to model it. So I think the questions are about this, partitioning.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, you just said, water, oil, partitioning, and these proteins have got these specific, very specific sites for this
hormone.
The proteins may also have, like you said, very specific interactions with the receptor on the target cell. Even though everything is in 5 liters of blood and it's so distributed you can't track a single molecule, then there has to be something, again, more specific about delivery. So, you know, even though you might not know the answer now, if it would satisfy you to say that there is something specific about the protein carrier and leave it like that, and then, you know, maybe we can find that out, that's what we'd start to model, and that would give us specificity.
I'm sure there are mathematical models where you're looking at binding constants and diffusion constants, and it's a darn good question, and I have absolutely no idea.
Okay. So if you can say that almost to every question that you don't know about, then...
I have no problem with saying I have absolutely no idea. I study a lot about signal transduction, but there's no way one human being can know everything there is to know, so I'm sure you guys are going to come up with all sorts of great questions, because you're scientists, and you go... And I just say, okay, it binds onto a carrier protein, which makes it too large to enter the red blood cell. And once it gets to its actual target, then there's probably some kind of dissociation constant going on that you mathematicians can put numbers to. And it comes off that carrier protein and then enters its target cell. But then there's the whole question of how does it know where to go?
There's no knowledge here, but this is the cold that the others are trying to close.
There's no knowledge here. I like that.
I'm using the carrier protein.
Now, you don't have this problem. We don't have to worry about this problem when you're dealing with water-soluble hormones. Because water-soluble hormones are soluble in water. So they are hydrophilic. They have no problem in traveling through the bloodstream. But the problem, number one problem, is once they get to the lipid bilayer, they can't enter the cell through diffusion. They can't enter the cell by crossing the lipid bilayer, oil-water phenomena again. So most of these the water-soluble hormones trigger a cellular response by binding on to specific receptors displayed on the surface. And this, again, is just a little cartoon diagram showing you surface receptors. Here's our little ligand. You'll notice that the ligand is specific for a receptor. It isn't just a willy-nilly interaction. There has to be an actual physical interaction between the ligand and the receptor. And I likened it to a key in a lock. You put the key in the lock, you turn the lock, the door opens. So this ligand has to not only fit in the actual keyhole, but it's got to be able to turn it. Some of these ligands may be able to fit in the keyhole, but they don't turn it. So it's an extremely specific react. And there are all sorts of research groups out there that do these three-dimensional models, and they put these nice little ribbon diagrams up, and you look at it and go, yeah, it makes complete sense to me. So, but there are a lot of people who will do this modeling kind of. And then you get in, there are a lot of groups also that deal with the mathematics of this binding, the dissociation constants, how the affinity of one receptor will be towards a ligand, and there are all sorts of areas of mathematics that deal with that too. Now, generally, when water-soluble hormones bind on, it results in a lot of cells, something called a second messenger. So the actual cellular response is called a second messenger system, and this is a series of signaling events that eventually lead to the final cellular response, and that's what we're going to look at today. Just to give you an idea of some of the lipid-soluble hormones you may be familiar with, the main class of lipid-soluble hormones are steroids. These are lipid-based. They're derived from cholesterol. They're made in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Basically, you just end up with a cholesterol backbone, which is these fused carbon rings here. Stick on various different kinds of functional or side groups, and you get entirely different lipid steroid hormones. So aldosterone will have these kinds of functional groups. This is a lipid steroid hormone that functions in water balance. But if you turn around and stick an entirely different group on, you may end up with estrogen or progesterone or testosterone or cortisol, things like that. Another group of your lipid-soluble hormones you may have heard of are the thyroid hormones. These are basically tyrosine rings that have iodines attached on. system, stick one on, stick two on, stick three on, you end up with triiodothreonine or T3. You combine, I believe, a couple of these thyroid hormone precursors, you end up with the main one, T4, which is just basically a series of tyrosine rings with four iodides attached onto it. And T3 and T4 are our main hormones that control cellular metabolism, determine our metabolic rate. And then there are the retinoids, which are vitamin A derivatives, which we won't even cover. Now, the water-soluble hormones, things like serotonin, melatonin, histamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, these are probably a lot of hormones that you've heard of. They are either just groups of small amino acids that have been modified in some way. Small peptides, maybe groups of 50 or 100 amino acids strung together. Or they can be large protein hormones with very specific three-dimensional conformational shapes. The larger peptide hormones, things like insulin and glucagon, which we're all pretty familiar with. Then there's a group actually called the echinocytes, which are derived from a fatty acid called arachidonic acid. And they basically, this derivation pathway leads to two main classes, prostaglandins and leukotrienes. Now, we all know what leukotrienes are because we watch commercials and we watch about, what is it, what are those antihistamine, new antihistamine drugs? Things like Claritin and what's the newest one? Aloe vera, I think. Aloe vera, which acts again either histamine or leukotrienes. Together with histamine, the leukotrienes are involved in inflammatory responses, as are prostaglandins. Every cell in your body makes prostaglandins. And the prostaglandins and leukotrienes are involved in inflammatory responses. So now when you will watch those little fancy schmancy commercials and they say acts against leukotrienes, now you can go, aha, an echinocyte derived from arachidonic acid. The funny thing about biology is you make a rule. Okay, if you're a lipid-soluble hormone, you diffuse across the plasma membrane and you bind onto receptors inside the cell. If you're a water-soluble hormone, you have to bind onto receptors on the cell surface. Well, every time you make a rule in biology, there's always an exception. Always. 99% of the time. This is an example of an exception. Prostaglandins, actually, despite being lipophilic, are a little too large, or they don't have an optimal shape for squeezing through the plasma membrane, and they actually bind to cell surface receptors. So there's an exception to your rule. Lipid-soluble hormones, again, here they is transporter carrier protein, again through some mechanism I don't understand or have no knowledge of. The hormone is freed, diffuses into the cell. It actually gets translocated into the nucleus where it binds onto receptors, or it can bind onto receptors in the cytosol and then get translocated. But the practical upshot of which is this activated receptor hormone complex literally physically binds onto very specific sequences of DNA called response elements. And once this ligand receptor DNA sequence interaction takes place, either expression of a gene gets turned on or expression of a gene gets turned off. And again, this results in a very specific type of cellular activity. These genes, if they get turned on, they result in new proteins, and maybe you end up with increased proliferation. Or maybe if you turn this gene expression off, this protein doesn't get made, and the cell stops proliferating.
What are the timescales that we'll be talking about in such a case? This thing shuts off the gene?
Let me think. You're actually looking on, it depends on what kind of hormone. You can, in vitro, in tissue culture, I can get an effect within minutes, within seconds, or some may take within hours. Again, it all depends how much hormone is in the system. Hormones act pretty quickly, and they actually have a very long-term effect. So this will not only happen very quickly, but can persist for hours, days, and weeks. But in terms of actual timing, you're looking at the order of seconds to minutes to hours, depending on the hormone. Translocation into the nucleus and binding.
Gene machinery first has to do something.
And that depends on cell type, too. The actual machinery of an epithelial cell may have an entirely different time course, say, of that of a muscle cell or that of a bone cell. So the rates of transcription and translation could vary from cell to cell. I'm sure there are lots of articles out there that have studied each cell and they know their timing.
Okay.
Now, the water-soluble hormones, this is sort of the classic cell signaling mechanism. When you guys learn, when you study receptor-ligand interactions and cell signaling, this is what you end up with most of the time. You have, again, the binding of a hormone, and they call it a first messenger to a receptor. Specific ligand-receptor interaction. This physically interacts with a protein located on the inside surface of the plasma membrane. It's called a G protein. And this G protein will then go and interact with another protein that will convert ATP into a second messenger. So you have a series of protein-protein interactions that take place on the inside here of the plasma membrane. And there's an actual physical interaction that's required between the receptor ligand and these internal cytosolic proteins. You end up with increased levels of CAMP. When we talk about second messengers and cell signaling, CAMP is usually the prototypical second messenger that we study. And this CAMP, through a whole bunch of series of events, what it just generally does is it sets up a cascade. It activates a protein, and that protein gets activated, and it activates its target. And that activated target goes and activates its target. So you have a cascade of proteins that are become activated and activated and activated until eventually you end up with your ultimate cellular effect. Now this activation is through a process of phosphorylation, sticking on a phosphate group. And these proteins that perform the phosphorylation are called kinases. So CAMP will activate a protein kinase, one type of protein kinase, and that will go on and phosphorylate and activate its targets. And then that will go on and activate and phosphorylate its targets. And what you end up with is something called a signal transduction cascade that eventually leads to cellular effect.
Is that like an amplification?
Yes, it is.
The idea to amplify the original signal?
Exactly. And that's why it's such a powerful signaling mechanism, because one CAMP molecule may activate one protein kinase, one protein kinase enzyme. That will go on and activate 10 of its targets. Those will go on and activate 100 of its targets, because every kinase has a specific activity. Some of them can phosphorylate very quickly and rapidly and can do 100 in, you know, a blink of an eye, and then some of them are slower. So that's one of the powers of this system, is that it's amplification. One receptor ligand resulting in maybe the phosphorylation of 100,000 kinases eventually down the bottom.
We're also interested in structure in these kind of cells and then mechanisms. Mm-hmm.
So yes, some of them are.
So there's already a membrane structure here.
Right.
We're also very interested in the diffusion and the transport processes. So accessibility of the ligand there for its target. So the enzyme, you know, activates another enzyme. How are these enzyme-enzyme interactions organized inside the cell then, if they're all bound to membranes?
Well, let me see if I'm understanding.
Just the physical proximity of the cascade, how is it organized in the cell, with things bound to membrane?
A lot of this binding to membrane also takes place after activation. So some of them, upon activation, will then go to the plasma membrane where they interact with more and then continue. So not all of them have to physically associate with a membrane,
but
some of them do.
Okay, most of this is very close to the plasma membrane too, right?
Right, and it's also a physical conformation. That ligand receptor interaction changes the shape, and that actually change in shape binds onto the G protein, which sets up a signal which recruits the adenyls, with the actual protein that makes CAMP is called adenyl cyclase.
Now, this is really awesome. This is exactly what we need to hear, because this is a cataloging of the events and a cataloging of the components. And I think what we're going to be interested in as we go through this week is other mechanisms by where these things happen, and more to do with the materials properties that allow them to perform their actions. This term activation it doesn't mean anything to this audience. It just doesn't.
No.
I mean, it means something has happened,
mm-hmm.
but you know, what does activation really mean in terms of when you say conformational change? To us, that's a strain.
Yeah,
it's a strain of a material. And that strain requires a stress. That stress represents elasticity or viscosity of the material. And so, you know, this is really great cataloging for us to now start to think more about the physical things that are happening.
Oh, okay. that's it. Yeah, and I look at it from a different point. I look at it, okay, all right, there's a shape change. And I'm looking at, when I think of shape change, again, that key in the lock phenomenon,
yeah,
that it's just basically by phosphorylating and changing its shape just slightly, it enables it maybe to interact with another target, or maybe get translocated up to the plasma membrane where it physically interacts with the plasma membrane.
That word again doesn't mean anything, interact.
Really? The actual physical binding and coming
exactly
together these two.
It's
okay.
A physical binding.
Yeah.
The interaction just covers a whole multitude.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. And then actually, there's a lot of ways. There are the mathematical modeling systems that can say, all right, if we do this and this, this much is going to bind to this much, and that's so.
Well, that's
yeah.
The kind of physics and chemistry.
That also you all the chemical reaction.
Exactly. Yeah, it covers a whole multitude of things. So interaction and activation.
You're gonna see lots of those words up here then.
Okay, that's great.
So basically, when you look at cell surface receptors, there are four classes that I just want to hit on. The first class are called G protein coupled receptors. And as their name would imply, they're going to couple or bind, or using the general term, interact with a G protein, which is what I showed on the previous slide. Now these guys are involved in a wide range of signaling pathways, and many, many cells in our body utilize this mechanism to signal within themselves. And it includes things like light detection, the photoreceptors in your retina, odorant detection, the olfactory receptors in your nose, detection of very specific hormones, things like, what would be an example, estrogen, would use these kinds. And neurotransmitters, other neurotransmitters, would use this kind of a signaling mechanism. I just want to show you what these things look like, physically cartoon-wise. Probably doesn't mean anything, but there it is. Now, these G protein-coupled receptors, again, ligand receptor binding, physical change in shape, allows it now to physically interact with a G protein that is attached to the inside of the plasma membrane. This again activates or changes its shape and allows it to physically interact with an effector protein called adenylyl cyclase. And this is the adapter protein, or the effector protein, that converts ATP into the second messenger, cAMP. Now, depending on regulating this actual effector, you can either turn this signaling pathway on or turn this signaling pathway off. And that is because the cells have evolved a really neat mechanism. If you want to turn the cell on, you need this physical interaction. You get a specific change in shape, cAMP gets produced. But our cells have also evolved different kinds of G proteins that turn this whole entire mechanism off, so that this inhibitory G protein, which is what it's called literally, physically interacts with this adenylyl cyclase effector and turns it off. So again, this all depends, again, on activation, shape change, physical binding with one another. And depending on how the shape changes, the effectors turn on or the effector turns off. And this allows fine-tuning, an extremely high level of fine-tuning of this signaling mechanism. We have things called ion channel receptors. These ligand-gated ion channels are found in high numbers in our nervous system. They're involved in the neuron generating the electrical impulse. And basically, the ligand binds onto its specific site. When it does, there's a change in shape again, and it allows the movement of an ion down its concentration gradient. Very, very important in the movement of sodium and potassium across the axon plasma membrane. We also find these in the plasma membrane of our muscle cells. The actual ligand that binds is called a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. You bind and open up these ion channels, you again get the movement of sodium and potassium, and eventually, down the line, muscle contraction. There are two other kinds that have very similar names. One is called tyrosine kinase-linked receptors, and other ones are called receptor tyrosine kinases. That confuses the heck out of me, I don't know about you guys. But this is sort of the same idea of a G-protein. G-protein-coupled receptor. This is a tyrosine kinase-linked receptor. And all of these, again, are found in the plasma membrane. And when they bind onto their ligand, they dimerize. So the first thing that happens is they bind onto their ligand, and you'll notice that a dimer, two identical receptor or protein tyrosine kinase-linked receptors, have to come together. And again, it's a key and a lock phenomena, an actual physical shape change. This physical shape change activates the receptor and enables it to physically bind or interact with these protein tyrosine kinases. So this is its target. You have to have binding in order for these targets to physically interact, and that physical interaction or binding activates it. Again, I hate to hit you those words, but you're getting phosphorylation events. This phosphorylated substrate, maybe it will lead to a specific effect, or maybe it's a kinase that will go and phosphorylate and activate a series or a cascade of targets. I'm just going to fill that in. Things, receptors for cytokines. Cytokines are soluble compounds that are secreted by things, immune cells. So interleukins would be an example of a cytokine. Interferons, which were first discovered when studied viral infected cells. These again are soluble compounds that are secreted by immune cells. I was going to fill some of those in. Sorry.
Actually, XXX works.
Makes sense? Okay. XXX. Really? Oh, okay. XXX. You notice that there's more X's here than there is there. Usually I highlight them in yellow too, like, hey dummy, don't forget to fill this in.
Actually, there are more cytokines than interferons.
There are, actually, yes. There's something on the order. How many cytokines? I don't even know how many cytokines 40 there are.
40-something.
40-something? Yeah, I mean, there's what, 20-something interleukins or something? I don't know. Every time you open up a book, they discover a new one. Let's just put it this way.
Maybe it's the same that they discovered before, but now with a different function.
They give it a different name. Just to confuse us, it's the same stupid thing, but we're going to give it a different name, too. I personally think they should come up with a different name for these things. Now, these protein tyrosine kinases, the word kinase says to me that it has the ability to phosphorylate, and it will participate in a signaling mechanism. And the word tyrosine says to me that it's going to phosphorylate tyrosine amino acids. So that's all tyrosine kinases mean. They stick proteins onto tyrosine amino acid residues. Now the last type is probably, together with the G-protein coupled receptor, the two prototypical signaling pathways. A lot of research is done on the various classes of receptors with intrinsic enzymatic activity. Sounds fancy, but all it is receptor tyrosine kinases, RTKs. Examples of these kind of pathways, you guys have heard of the MAPK pathway? Anyone heard of the MAPK? Perfect example. Do you work in MAPK?
EGF signal.
Ah, okay. So, similar to the tyrosine-linked kinases, the ligand binding here usually results in dimerization, but what's really cool about these receptors is that when the ligand and the receptor come together, when the dimer come together, instead of a physical interaction or a physical shape change that allows it to interact with another kinase, these guys actually have the ability to phosphorylate themselves. So they actually have kinase activity, and a lot of our receptors expressed on our surface in this class have the ability, once activated, to phosphorylate themselves and to phosphorylate targets. Things like the soluble protein hormones that act as growth factors, NGF, EGF, PDGF, which is platelet-derived growth factor, insulin-like growth factor, they all signal through this kind of an idea. Bind it onto the receptor becomes activated, and it phosphorylates a target. That target activates a target, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, down into a cascade.
Can I ask a dumb question? So from
I'm specializing those.
From Hama's lecture yesterday, so the picture we kind of have with these little diagrams you've drawn is there's this, I'm going to try to learn all the terms we had yesterday, there's this hydrophilic head, and then there's this alpha helix type thing going through, and then there's this hydrophilic tail. Now,
we taught you that yesterday?
So this ligand comes and presumably binds to the hydrophilic head.
Yeah.
Now, how is that, you know, supposed to somehow propagate through this coil thing, you know, to the bottom and make some change in the part that's inside the cell?
How
should
that allosteric effect?
Yeah.
Is another name that we give when binding or interaction or any physical contact transmit through the body of the protein into a distant site, and that's called allosteric effect. Another way to say we don't know how, but they they just they transmit in there, and that is one of the mysteries of enzymology and finding how allostery happened.
Mm.
And so it is a subject that would be good to treat in a more quantitative way.
But you read all these articles, and like you said, the upshot is we don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't a clue.
Try to find out
yeah, I haven't a clue on how that actual physical shape change gets transmitted through, but I just take it on faith that it does.
It depends on the structure of the actual protein. They're actually the side chain of the amino acids that actually make physical contact, so maybe the beta carbon sort of pushes the, you know, and so it happens.
Yeah, and actually studying these shape changes is no easy thing. I mean, when you look at three-dimensional protein, you work with people who look at modeling of three-dimensional proteins and how they interact with the plasma membrane. That's no easy thing.
Well, that we know.
Oh, Lord. I don't even, it goes right over my head.
I mean, it can't be that complicated. In some cases, I'm sure it goes back to the stuff that they...
Oh, I think it can be that complicated.
No, I mean, in the sense, you could say, how does a toilet operate? Or I pull the string and that causes some conformation and change in my toilet, and then suddenly it makes it flush. Well, what goes on is that I'm transmitting stresses through parts of the structure,
yeah,
and they change
mm-hmm.
things. I
yeah.
mean,
mm-hmm.
well, protein, if something binds there, you release a couple of kilocalories from all
yeah.
somewhere, that's enough energy to do something.
Yeah.
Or
some
protein.
Yeah. But the problem, what about the word? The problem is, what I get with that is stress. Stress is such a general, broad, encompassing term.
Stress is what you're...
Well, not learning about physics.
But then for them,
we're talking about a toilet now? I have very bad luck with plumbing, so don't call it a toilet.
It's a very specific term, you know, to this audience. But one good example is the
alpha, beta, I'm sorry.
Yeah, just hang on. Have you done that?
No, she's not.
Well, just to say this example is that this there's a molecule that requires a dimer to form.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
I get to it actually.
Well, if you have a picture of that, because this is
no.
you may have this. Here's the beta thing, and the alpha is like this. And this is on the outside of the membrane. And when the ligand binds, these two come together and that opens up on the other side of the membrane. So that little kind of scissor movement requires then gives this access to what you have a cartoon of this. Now the question
to a matrix protein or
yeah,
some other kind of protein.
The question we need to ask then is, what is the property of this molecule that allows it to perform that action? And what is the property of this material? Now there's no biology in that.
No, there
isn't. What is the property of this material that allows it to perform this action, not what is the function of this protein? And that's the difference in language and difference in concepts that, you know, this. What you're presenting is awesome. What you're presenting is distance. What we're interested in is force
right.
and time.
Right.
There's no force and time on that diagram, it's just distance. And so there's only two out of the three units that we use represented in this kind of talk.
Now, when I know a receptor and a ligand interact with one another and there's a physical shape change, like you said, you pull on the plug, I don't know if they still understand the driving force between binding. What is it that actually causes the conformational shape change? To me, that's sort of an esoteric concept. Where as a biologist, I go, you know what? I really don't care. All I know is that when ligand A binds onto receptor B, it changes its physical shape, and that allows it to carry out its ultimate function. But maybe here in this group, you guys are wondering about the actual force that drives maybe that turning of the key in the lock.
Well, you would presumably care because, in principle, then you could try to design a molecule
mm-hmm.
that would do something just a little bit different
yeah, yeah.
if you understood what was making it work. And
or repair one that didn't do it in
right.
disease.
Right.
And so now our concepts here are now about what changes in that structure or its composition, its structure, its properties that don't allow it to perform its function. And again, this is materials engineering view of nanoscale materials.
Well, it's also the idea of antagonists that bind physically onto a receptor but don't induce that physical shape change.
That's just, again, a description
yeah.
of the other side of the same coin. It's the same, we're talking about the same physical interactions and the same materials. You know, a protein is just a polymer. These things could be made out of polyethylene with different side chains. Because the polyvinyl chloride, polyvinyl styrene,
bad words.
But they're like,
yeah.
they're not magic.
It's a building block.
Well, they're, but the point is, the tyrosine that you talked about, when it gets the phosphate, right, that's a negative charge. And that's a force placed in a very specific place in that molecule, you know, which is missed out when you say activation, you know, phosphorylation. But actually, a negative charge
mm-hmm.
is a very powerful mechanical device. You know, it's a change in the...
I don't know how you guys look at this. It's like, wow, I just never thought
about
looking at it that way.
Yeah, we're just starting to do that. That's kind of what this group's about. I'm teaching a class, I've developed a class, you know, at Duke, and we've done it for 3 years now. These are the kind of things that we're talking about in terms of a hierarchy scale and a materials design view of exactly these pictures.
I think about that kind of stuff and I get a headache.
We get headache looking at these pictures.
Good. Then we're both going to come out of the seminar with headaches.
So
did everyone see my fancy animation?
Yeah, I'm sure to qualify the we because we are a bit of a inhomogeneous audience. I mean, there.
Yeah.
One thing that we learned here is that the same thing that's going on causes different questions in different heads. Some aspect, how does it happen? Why does it happen? What does it trigger? And those are all very valid questions.
Yeah,
yeah.
We have different receptors.
Yeah.
So look, everyone. I mean, one of the problems
are wired differently than
this
mine.
This is a common problem for our 14-week programs. If people try to compress the whole 14 weeks into the tutorial period, and you know, so basically, let's try to just kind of get questions on the table and leave them there for now because that's kind of what we're trying to get to.
Oh, I love it. That means I do less up here. I just go, uh-huh, and then you guys go nuts for an hour, and I go, great, that was fun, thanks.
You think we'll let you leave?
Oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't matter. I'll stay here, yeah, all morning, and you know, just go, oh. Just take it on faith that this is going to happen.
But you're on campus. We know where you live.
We can go to your lab, which is fine. I invite you all to drop by my lab.
Yeah.
Well, actually,
look at cells differentiating.
No, actually, lab tours are something we like to have.
Oh, our lab is really messy. It's really not much to look at, but, you know,
well,
you can come on by. We can give you an idea of what we're doing, definitely.
Yeah.
If you've seen my office, you'll know
field
the messiness of the air. Go ahead. Please.
Okay, well, from a pure biological standpoint, this is basically, and I'll show you again my fancy schmancy animation. Look. So basically, isn't that nice? The successive phosphorylation of these multiple kinases results in a signal transduction cascade. And this is a lot of, when we look at this kind of a prototypical idea, these are what receptor tyrosine kinases. This is the main way, the main mechanism of receptor tyrosine kinases. Now the funny thing is when I was doing my PhD back at Wayne State, there used to be seminars on this. And I used to go to these seminars and I would learn about MAPK. Mitogen activated protein kinase. This would be the bottom kinase here. Now the kinase that phosphorylates MAPK is called MAP kinase kinase, or MEK, M-E-K. So there's this one. The kinase that phosphorylates MEK is called MAP kinase kinase kinase, or MEKK. MEK, M-E-K-K. Yeah, exactly. Now we're getting into math. M-E-K squared, M-E-K cubed. And my head would do this. And I would fall asleep in this lecture. So I don't know, it's some kind of cosmic force up there that is now getting back at me because this is all I do all day. Signal transduction. So somebody's getting back at me for falling asleep in all those lectures. They're not the most creative guys and women. So when they find a kinase that phosphorylates a kinase, they call it a kinase of a kinase. And you maths, again, would call it MEK squared, MEK cubed. And there's even MEK to the fourth. It's ridiculous. So a little bit about these second messengers, because really this is where the amplification phenomena comes in. It's one thing to get one receptor and one ligand to activate, and it produces one molecule of second messenger, but this is how amplification occurs in our cell signaling. Produced by the activation of these G protein coupled receptors and these receptor tyrosine kinases, again, you get CAMP is the most commonly studied second messenger. Although CAMP does not function in signaling pathways that are initiated by receptor tyrosine kinases, it's entirely possible that these RTK pathways will activate a target and that will go on to affect second messenger creation. So you get the idea that these two kinds of big prototypical pathways interact with one another at multiple levels. And one of these levels could be at the production of a second messenger. The actual, just in case you want to know, the actual kinases that these CAMPs activate are called protein kinase A or CAMP-dependent kinases. But it has a wide variety of effects. And again, it all depends on the cell you're talking about. It could cause, in adipocytes, increased CAMP activates a protein kinase that stimulates the production of fatty acids. But in ovarian cells, this same second messenger will activate a different PKA, and that will result in increased estrogen synthesis. So it's what I think is really cool is that it's a similar mechanism. It's the same second messenger, but all depending which target kinases you throw into the cell, you get an entirely different cellular effect. Now, to me, I find that, I think that's kind of neat. It's sort of, now we get into the idea of evolution, which I'm sure you guys love, but over evolution, our body has evolved similar mechanisms that if you just fine-tune in a very specific way, you get an entirely different developmental effect. So you get the idea of redundancy and alteration of these redundant kind proteins and an entirely different cellular effect. That's an extremely efficient way, I think, of operating the machine of the human body. And we've evolved that over millions of years. Again, the idea of amplification. One epinephrine molecule can bind one G protein-coupled receptor, and this synthesizes multiple CAMPs, goes on and activates maybe 1,000 times more PKAs. And actually, a blood level, I saw this in the textbook, a blood level as low as 10 to the minus 10 molar, now that's 1/10 of a nanomolar, right? 10 to the minus 9 nanomolar, can then raise blood glucose levels by 50%. Mm. What a phenomenal amplification mechanism.
How many molecules is this if you minus 10?
Oh, I don't know. No, wait a minute. Let's see. Avogadro's number is 6.9.
Into the 13.
Six
one
to
is
10
six
to the power to the 3.
Yeah, there you go. Negative 23? I don't know how many molecules. I don't know.
It depends on the volume.
Depends on, yeah, epinephrine.
At least a bunch.
Yeah.
That's good.
10 to the minus 10 molar. What's that? 10 to the minus 10 moles per liter.
But you do have a biological. I mean, you say it's fascinating. I think most people in this group should be told that it makes no sense.
Really?
The same second messenger has multiple very specific effects. That's something that really is very peculiar biologically. And I don't want to take any more of your time, but I think people need to draw their attention to the fact that, I mean, calcium is also another classic question. Every time you have something bind to a receptor, you have an influx of intracellular calcium. One time it does this specific thing, one time it does this specific thing, and one time it does this specific thing. It's still the same calcium.
Yeah.
And there really isn't, in many of these cases, an understanding of how you have a specific reaction to a generalized second messenger or to calcium.
And this is
so
the problem with signal transduction.
There's still a missing basic understanding of a lot of the mechanisms of signal transduction. If you have a kinase phosphorylation cascade, and all the kinases are specific to a particular pathway, there's no problem. But when you have a generalized second messenger or a calcium-induced phenomenon, that there really is still a fundamental problem of how you get specificity.
Well, this is the problem with single transduction. I do kind of a disservice here by showing you kinase 1, kinase 2, kinase 3, kinase 4.
Yeah, but
or CAMP protein kinase A. It does us kind of a disservice to look at it in black and white. You have to realize that at any one time, say to proliferate, your cells in the kidney are utilizing three distinct signal transduction mechanisms that all interact at various levels along this kinase cascade, so that this second messenger acts, even though it's a general molecule, it's just a derivative of ATP, in your kidney cells, it may promote the uptake of sodium and chloride. And if you turn around and you have maybe just one different arm of the signal transduction pathway different in your lung epithelial cells, you're going to get this second messenger that results in increased mucus production or increased chloride transport. So it's sort of a disservice. When you start to learn about signal transduction, you go, got it. MAP kinase, kinase, MAPK kinase, and it activates CFOS, and I get increased phosphorylation. Then I got it, totally. All right, G proteins, this, that. And then you go on PubMed. And you start to read the articles out there. And you're like, okay, wait a minute. So now the, oh, good grief. Now there's a MAPK kinase pathway, and then there's the PI3K kinase, and they interact, and oh, geez. And now, wait a minute. This group said that it increases in this group. So it's an extremely dynamic system, if I can use that generalized word, where it's not just one pathway. You know how I said no cell is an island? No pathway is an island either. And there's such a phenomenal level of interaction, which gives our cells the power to fine-tune a very generalized second messenger.
So let me ask them sort of a general question about this. So you can imagine the questions that James has raised that, I mean, there are two situations. One is where the same type of cell reacts differently in different circumstances, and the other is just different cells reacting differently to the same thing. So obviously at base with the different cells, there are certain genes whose expression has been blocked in that cell and not in another. And to what extent is it that these cells, by these blockages, have created a different molecular environment inside
mm-hmm.
themselves initially, or is it that,
yeah.
or is it just that you have this signal thing which would, if this gene were not blocked, come and release a product, but it's actually acting at the genetic level, or is it
yes.
mediated?
So when I talk about here, that the difference maybe between adipocytes and ovarian cells is that maybe this protein kinase isoform that's in adipocytes isn't even expressed in ovarian cells. So there automatically is a level of regulation. Or maybe this protein kinase that's activated in adipocytes is incapable of being activated in an ovarian cell because whatever needs to activate this PKA doesn't exist. So you are right in that every cell type has an extremely distinct environment with a distinct, what I call a repertoire of genes that are either turned on or turned off.
There's also spatial localization
mm-hmm.
of signal molecules,
right.
which can be very important. If the cyclic AMP is released at a particular location, it's going to tend to bind
mm-hmm.
things that are near that location. And so that's another method of specificity. It can create specificity.
Exactly. Now, some of the other second, we mentioned calcium. Calcium is actually a very widely studied second messenger. Other second messengers include IP3 and DHE, diacylglycerol, derived from the lipid phosphatidyl inositol. And again, the breakdown, actually IP3 production also results in the production of another second messenger, calcium. IP3 can actually tell the ER to open up calcium channels and allow an increase in cytosolic calcium. Now, calcium in beta pancreatic beta cells triggers the exocytosis of insulin. Again, a different effect in muscle cells eventually leads to contraction. And a lot of groups also study the interaction of calcium with calcium-responsive proteins and calcium-responsive genes, things like calmodulin, the complex of calcium calmodulin. But there are a lot of calcium-responsive proteins and genes out there that respond to this second messenger. So 60 minutes, or 70 minutes, or however long we're going to go on for, isn't enough time to cover it.
But some of the principles that underlie this are kind of what we're discussing. When you put calcium up there, you're really meaning Ca2+,
mm-hmm.
which, is kind of important.
I just didn't want to write Ca2+, because I hate, we'll get the superscript function.
Yeah, but that's important to us, because that's a positive charge or a divalent ligand. And many of the side chains on proteins, well, three or four of them, have got negative charges on them at neutral pH. And some of the proteins, within all the PKAs of the ligand. So there are negative charges on proteins, and the phosphate, the phosphorylation.
It's negative charge. It's a highly negative charge.
Right. So what we're interested in now is more of what these words mean in terms of the physical forces and times associated with those scales or distances.
Just let me throw something out there, more interested in terms of ionic and covalent bonding and the forces that are generated by those bonds?
At some point we will be. This, like I said, this is the catalog, and underneath all that will be these van der Waals attractions, the electrostatics that's involved, the water that has to come off if a bond
mm-hmm.
is formed, so that's hydration, dehydration, the vibration potentials, fluctuations in the position because of temperature.
Puts a pain right there.
Yeah.
Ow! I just want to bring, now, to talking about this, I just wanted to toss up here probably the most best characterized receptor signal transduction pathway. This is an RTK pathway called the MAP kinase pathway. And there, you can read extensive amounts of literature on the MAPK pathway. You get, for example, EGF binding onto its receptor. And that receptor activation will activate an adapter protein called RAF GTPase. And then that goes and activates another protein called RAF. And that, again, all these MEK cubed, MEK squared, MEK. Until eventually you get the ultimate cellular effect, which may be activation of a transcription factor that turns on a gene that results in increased proliferation. And there are multiple articles out there that deal with MAPK. Oh, what is this? Well, I think I'll just skip over this. We don't have time. And again, I brought up this idea that common signaling pathways are initiated by different receptors in a class. So you get this little cartoon here that shows you the idea that a G protein interacting with a hormone-stimulated GPCR goes along, produces a second messenger. But this RTK pathway and all of the proteins that interact and activate it could perhaps modify production of the second messenger, or maybe further downstream. They both act on the final cellular target. And the idea of very common pathways, depending on which pathways interact with one another, can produce a very specific cellular effect. Stop me when you guys want to go get a break.
Where are you in terms of your presentation?
It depends on how far you want me. We can talk a little bit about cell-cell adhesion, or if you guys have had enough. All right. Now, I went very general with cell-cell adhesion, because I didn't really know how much Hama had covered, what he had covered. So I just dealt from a very basic point. Maybe it's too basic for you guys. I don't know. Stop me if it's too basic. But we got all these signal transduction pathways. Okay, so we know the underlying signaling mechanism of what happens in cells. And hormones can bind onto receptors, ligands can bind onto receptors, but actual physical interaction from cell to cell or cell to the substrate can turn on these same signal transduction mechanisms. So first we learn about the signal transduction mechanisms, and then we learn that there are a variety of cellular interactions that can turn these on. When you're talking about cell-to-cell adhesion and cell-to-substrate or cell-to-matrix adhesion, you're dealing with a series of proteins that are called cellular adhesion molecules, or short form, CAMs. These allow interactions with each other and with the surrounding extracellular matrix. And what this produces is a cohesive sheet of cells that coordinate and function together. How? Well, basically, we now know that these interactions from cell to cell or cell to matrix results in activation of very specific signal transduction cascades that lead to the desired effect. And if one cell does the same, has the same effect, the other cell has the same effect, et cetera, you get millions of cells with the same effect. Your epithelial lining in your intestine absorbs, or your smooth muscle in your aorta contracts. So we're all looking at this coordination. One of the best examples that you can look up, actually, are the cellular interactions between an adhesion protein called beta-1 integrin, and the activation of beta-1 integrin actually activates the MAPK cascade. And there are a lot of research that's being done out there. Little pretty diagram here showing you all the various classes of how a cell can interact. It either interacts with itself, or maybe it interacts with the extracellular matrix. And the matrix is composed of things like collagens, and the fibrous collagens, laminins, fibronectins, protein sugar complexes called proteoglycans. Did Hama cover?
The same figure, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Same book.
Oh, it's the Bible. Actually, I got the CD from him, so we're probably up to the I helped him teach
What's
graduate students in biomedical. It's Molecular Biology, the Cell by Lodish. It's this thick now.
Okay, I got a new edition.
Yeah, what's the new edition, fifth or sixth? I have the fourth at home. Not that it changes, really. The new edition is probably the
fourth. I have the fourth and the fifth.
How do you spell the author's name?
Lodish, L-O-D-I-S-H. Harvey, I believe, is his first name, Harvey Lodish. There's also the Alberts. It's another one. Yeah. I myself, there's two camps in molecular biologists. You're either the Lodish camp or you're the Alberts camp. I'm the Lodish camp. I don't like the Alberts.
I think I have Alberts.
Yes, the Alberts is thinner. The Lodish, there's no way a Lodish textbook's that thin. It's usually like that. So there's two camps. You're either the Lodish or the Alberts. I have both. I think the Alberts is nice because in general, it doesn't. The Lotus has a lot of experiments. Like it gives you the concepts of the experiments that led to these points. But where the Alberts is just very simple and describes the concepts. So the various kinds of cams we have on ourselves, three main kinds. Actually, there's four, but I just put three here. The first type are called cadherins. These are involved in cell-to-cell adhesion between like cells. They are calcium dependent, so again the idea that a divalent cation has to bind on to these proteins to allow them to dimerize and to allow cells to adhere to one another. This may be an example here of, say, two cadherins physically interacting with one another to bring two cells together. The Ig superfamily of CAMs, or what I just call the CAMs, are again involved in cell-cell adhesion. Things like neural CAM, vascular CAM, NCAM, VCAM. These are calcium independent. They do not require the binding to calcium. Some of them are actually found enriched in specific cell types. In neural tissue, you'll find an enrichment of or a high level of NCAM, whereas in vascular tissues, you'll find high levels of VCAM. And then there are the integrins. And these are the major cell matrix adhesion molecules, although they are involved in weakly binding cells to one another.
And they have been involved since the beginning during embryogenesis.
Oh, very much so.
So they're right from the start. They're receptors that tend to organize tissues.
Yeah. And it is because as they interact, these signaling pathways get turned. For the next lecture after the break, I talk a little bit about development. I didn't really, when it said cell differentiation and apoptosis, I looked at it and went, what do you want me to talk about? So I talk a little bit about that. Now, cell-to-cell adhesion, the cadherin junctions, basically two kinds, the adherence junctions and the desmosomes. But again, these are a mechanism of cells to interact with one another. Basically, you have cadherins interacting, physically joining up with each other in the presence of calcium. And the cool thing about these adherins and desmosomes is that they link the internal cytoskeleton to one another. So it's a good, strong bond. You've got cell to cell, and the actual cytoskeleton, the actin molecules, or maybe the keratin, the intermediate filaments, are linked up to these cadherins. And down here in this corner, whenever you look at, this is actually what the idea of what a desmosome would look like. And you can see it's a very strong interaction. You've got a lot of proteins that are involved in this. You've got intermediate filament proteins that physically connect with a plaque of proteins like desmoplakin and desmoglein. And these physically cross the plasma membrane to join up with the integrins and the plaque on the other side. So look at all this protein-protein interaction. An excellent opportunity for all this protein-protein interaction to turn on very specific signal transduction cascades. The cell matrix, if you guys are not already know, basically made up of insoluble collagens. I think there are how many now? 32? Again, you pick up a textbook, you'll find, you know. Proteoglycans, which are protein sugar composites, and the adhesive matrix proteins. This is sort of a general class, and it differs depending on what kind of tissue you're looking at. If you're looking at bone, these adhesive matrix proteins may be things like osteonectin and osteopontin, where it may differ, say, from other things, like maybe lamin and fibronectin, that kind of thing. And again, this different combination of extracellular matrix proteins. Again, the idea of an environment. Now, instead of dealing with an intracellular environment, we're dealing with an extracellular environment, so that this matrix, all depending where you are in the body, has a very unique composition. And depending on how it interacts with the cell, through what kind of cell adhesion molecule, it can turn signaling pathways on and off. And they've also found that the matrix can sequester growth factors. So even growth factors that would bind on to receptor kinase, they can physically be sequestered in the matrix. And that so that they're physically not able to bind onto the cell. And only until you digest away that matrix can you release these growth factors. So that's actually a really cool concept.
Can you give an example of that?
Of the ECM sequestering growth factors?
Yeah.
I think.
In fact, everything, almost.
Pretty much. FGF,
EGF,
VEGF,
they pass through the extracellular matrix,
yeah.
Which is like a. Almost like a chromatography column, and you step down according to size and charge.
Yeah,
and
just
distribution.
About.
And so those things are.
And so
in steady state with
and
the
so
plasma.
And so average release the growth factors in the collagenase?
No, when something happened in the cell that then you have a
receptor. Well, no, you would need a kind of collagenase. The cell, a lot of studies now are showing that tissues, as they develop, produce a wide variety of what are called proteases. That digest away the extracellular matrix, and that releases growth factors. So especially in embryogenesis, as these tissues are beginning to are forming, that this delicate balance between digesting the matrix and synthesizing the matrix results in a very specific level of growth factor that's available to the...
Or simply exposing or synthesizing the receptor that is more specific, and the energy of binding to that receptor
right.
is greater than
right.
to the... paper and sulfate, so they look like a aminoglycans, and then it shifts into the right receptor.
Why don't we leave it off here? Because I mean, this is just a little bit of a. I think I got integrins, and I think that's it. But here are some articles. Actually, there's only two more slides left. We talked about integrins. You mentioned integrins. Basically, again, it's a complex of either an alpha chain and a beta chain. Cells express multiple integrin types. This is how the cell physically interacts with the matrix. So, for example. If it expresses an alpha 1 and a beta 1 together, it can make a physical connection with collagens and laminins, or if it's alpha 5 chained in beta 1, it can interact with fibronectin. Activation of these integrins promotes cell signaling. So the formation of these focal adhesions that I mentioned up here, it's a complex of more than 20 proteins. Formation and activation of focal adhesions triggers a cascade that's initiated by, of course, a kinase. And that kinase is called focal adhesion kinase. And down we go through a cascade until eventually we result in increased cell growth or motility. Maybe this is how a cell crawls across a plate. Then finally, the last thing is the idea of gap junctions. You know, we concentrate so much on how cells are held together tightly in a tissue. And that cadherins hold cells tightly together. And that the integrins hold cells tightly, say, to the extracellular matrix. But there are, in addition to these very tight interactions, communication junctions that allow a free passage of materials between them. And these are called gap junctions. They're made up of a protein called connexon. And these connexons line up and form sort of these larger channels between the two plasma membranes. So that now you have this large channel where actual materials can diffuse back and forth. Now, this doesn't mean, again, that it's a free-for-all exchange, that you're just not going to have everything flowing willy-nilly between these cells. It has to be small enough to get through the channel. So I say that they're not free-swinging gates. Mostly, a lot of ions will pass in between cells this way. The compounds have to be small enough. This channel is filled with water, so it has to be a hydrophilic compound that goes in between the cells. The direction and rate of movement depends on these. The intercellular concentrations between the two cells. Great example of gap junctions, if you want to know where gap junctions are. Cardiac myocytes are held together, end on end, by structures called intercalated discs. And in those intercalated discs are a large number of gap junctions. This allows one cardiomyocyte to talk to another cardiomyocyte so that when they contract, they do it in a rhythmic, coordinated fashion. And I just tossed up some articles here, just off of PubMed, that just give you an idea of what's out there in terms of crosstalk between HGF and integrin pathways. ERK signaling pathways regulate differentiation of mesenchymal stem cells on collagen 1 and vitronectin. So there are, you type in cell adhesion matrix, and you end up with 42,000 references. So let me tell you, this is a hot area. Now, for me, as getting into biomedical engineering or working with Ben Wu, it's really cool because you've got all these signaling pathways, right? But we tend, as when I work with the clinicians, they tend to add growth factors. So a great example is craniofacial repair, the repair of a cleft palate. The plastic surgeon will go in and will stick in a physical scaffold of some kind of composition. He or she will fill it with cells. And they'll add a large dose of BMP2. BMP2 is a growth factor that's known to promote bone formation. The idea is that BMP2 is going to turn on the various appropriate signaling pathways, and the cells that are in that scaffold are going to form bone. And you fuse the cleft palate. But wouldn't it be really neat if we didn't have to add large quantities of BMP2? Wouldn't it be really cool if we could create a scaffold that simply through cellular adhesion to that scaffold, we turn on the exact same pathway and get the exact same effect? So now the idea of biomaterial engineering now is saying, hey, what do we need these growth factors for? If only we can understand the interaction, again, at the interface between membranes and cells and biomaterials, understand that interaction. We don't need growth factors anymore. All we have to do is physically change the solid support that these cells adhere to, and we can turn whatever pathway on we want. Now, it sounds easy standing up here, right? Not that easy.
Are you using these growth factors problematic?
Well, yeah, whenever you're dealing, I mean, they use such a high dose of growth factors to promote, say, bone formation, then all of a sudden you don't know what it's going to do systemically. In terms of cleft palate repair, you're dealing with a lot of young children, maybe even under a year. Do you want to add large doses of a growth factor to a kid that's a year old? Because you don't know what it's going to do systemically. So that allows a nice localized, and who knows what the BMP could diffuse off to some other cell and, you know, shut down the proliferation of endogenous bone cells, you know. So